Irene Grey, Reel 3.
All public air raid shelters were numbered, and the local residents knew, had been told, which shelter they were supposed to use, obviously to avoid overcrowding. It was also permissible for anybody caught out on the streets during an air raid, just walking through, to be allowed to rush in, of course, and take shelter. I have a vivid memory of one air raid shelter warden, who is no longer with us, Mrs. Constance West, a woman I shall always remember. She had been a professional dancer, and she was a very bubbly sort of person. You couldn't suppress her at all. And within a very short time, during the long air raids at night, she had got all the children in her shelter being taught to do ballet dancing, tap dancing, anything to occupy them, till it became to such a pitch that children in the other shelters were very jealous, and that we had quite several occasions when kids from other shelters tried to come into Mrs. West's shelter to learn dancing. But somehow, she managed to keep those kids free from fear as far as possible. Another shelter, a man brought in a portable gramophone, anything to cheer the long nights away. One night, looking in on this particular shelter, one elderly lady said to me, "Warden, can't you ask that man to stop playing his gramophone?" So I said, "Why, dear?" helps Pastor. "Yes, but it means we can't hear the bombs falling." Of course, a howl went up. All the better if you don't hear them coming. If it's going to cost your number on it, you'll have it and you won't know anything about it, which is very true. But the scene at night, looking in the shelters, so often during a long, horrific night, during the actual blitz period, I can see now the tired faces of the women whose husbands were away in the forces with their kiddies, huddled them in blankets, a few little sandwiches, if you could have found anything to make a sandwich with, telling them stories, singing to them anything to try and keep them. You knew inside they were terrified, but they didn't convey it to the children. And eventually the children would sleep. You'd see them doze off in their mother's arms. You'd find a woman, probably, whose baby was very nearly due. And that, of course, did cause problems. Nevertheless, babies were born in air raid shelters. During the Blitz period, if a woman's baby was near enough due, she would go to the shelter first prepared and stay the night in there, even though the air raid signal hadn't sounded. She would go prepared. Neighbours would be round her, ready to help. The nearby neighbours would organise it. To me, the spirit of women in those days far outshone anything else. It was very difficult to feed a young growing family to keep them healthy because rations were so meagre. And inevitably, it used to happen that parents used to forfeit their own rations for the sake of the children. The government certainly did all they could, I think, anyway. From birth to 5 years, every child was entitled to cod liver oil and orange juice, the two basic commodities, vitamin C, etc., for babes. When they became 5 years old, the mother had the option of exchanging the cod liver oil voucher for tea vouchers. I must be forgiven if my ration memories are not correct. I honestly cannot remember the exact amount we were all entitled to, but it was very, very meagre. If you went to visit a friend at all in the afternoon, you took with you, if you could afford it, your own teaspoonful of tea to put with the others. Meat was almost non-obtainable. You could sometimes get offal, you know, the odd sausage and things. But I spent such a lot of time on meals. My main meal seemed to be, looking back, when I could buy a tin of Pilchards and put it in pastry, if I had any fat to make pastry with. People have no conception of how, but somehow you manage to scrape up meals. It was the same with clothing. Clothing was you were issued with clothing coupons. Each coupon had a certain value. All clothing, and there was very little of it anyway, had a certain value coupon number. And every time you bought anything, if you managed to, you had to surrender the equivalent value coupon. And the same applied with almost everything. Furniture was almost impossible to get. You had a docket, you had to get priority dockets from the local council, and they would ask you about your circumstances, seeing if you really needed it. And if they didn't think you did, well, you just didn't get the docket. So you gradually saw your home disappear, worn out, things like this.
Did you have a home? You know, you were married quite soon before the war,
1937, yes.
So had you got a little home together?
Yes, and we were very terrified of losing it in case we did in the bombing. It was still not in this house, still in Testwood, only a stone's throw away. At the time my husband and I were married, I think it was just about then when it became possible for what I call the ordinary working man and woman to consider buying a house. Up till then, it had only been people with money. So we had seen our parents, my husband more than myself, living in the same house for all their married life, renting it, never owning a brick. My husband will tell you without any shame, he was one of 11. There were big families then. And, as you can imagine, it was a terrific struggle to bring up a family of 11, which was the average number of children. And when we, just before we married, I say it became possible to take out a mortgage for the ordinary person. And from the experience of his father, all those years he was married, and he didn't own a brick after paying rent, he bought it several times over in his rent. But we decided that when we married, we were going to start buying our own house. So when we could, we saved as much as we could over the years. We were engaged 2 years before we married. And eventually there was a new estate built out here in Testwood. You passed it on the way in. And the houses then, I had a very nice little three-bedroomed house with a lounge and a kitchen and a bathroom, which was heaven, because in those days people didn't have bathrooms. And for that we had to pay the complete price of £495. It is true. We had to put a deposit down of £25, which took us, the two of us, two solid years to find the £25. After we managed the deposit, of course, we married and we shifted in. But then within, say, 2 years, the war came. And we started married life with basically just the actual items we needed, the same as most people did in those days. You got the house over your head first and then furnished it as and when you could. We bought, funnily enough, this dining table. It is the same one, 58 solid years use, the dining set. We bought our bedroom suite. We had to have a bed to sleep in. And the kitchen cooker. And that was all. When we occasionally could manage to add to it in the furniture ways, we did. But by the time war came, you couldn't get anything else. In any case, it was only my husband's salary. I was no longer working. I couldn't. And the fear was, of course, well, now what happens if we lose our home? We're committed to that mortgage price. It doesn't sound much now, but in those days, believe you me, it was. We married on my husband's salary, on the old money, of course, £2.10 a week. And out of that, the mortgage had to be paid, the rates and everything else. At night time, our bedtime drink was cocoa made with water. Milk was only 2 pence a pint, but I could only afford to buy one half a pint a day. And I was typical of the majority of people. I wasn't just an outstanding case. Anyway, somehow people survived. And with the birth of my son, of course, I was home. And then it was a case, a very active toddler, the same as all women. I'm not one alone. This applied to all women with children. You eventually came to the pitch where perhaps the little girl wanted a new dress or the little boy wanted a new top. You rummaged through your husband's wardrobe to see if he'd got a shirt or something he could do without. So you cut down. Or else you attended a jumble sale in the hope that you'd be able to pick up somebody's cast-off coat or something, again, with enough material in it to cut down to a good food. I know my husband lost 2 pairs of trousers, which I cut down to make for my little son, John. And he used to cycle to his work with a patch on his trousers because you couldn't buy any anyway unless you had clothing dockets. At the time, I know I was, in one respect, a fortunate woman because my husband was home with me. I knew he was going to come back at night to me, God willing, because he was in shipbuilding. And although he joined them, he volunteered for the Navy, he was told he had to stay in his job. And the only thing in those days that made me a little bit cross when people didn't understand or didn't think before they spoke, any young man who was home, they derided, should have been in the forces. They couldn't all go, and my husband had been in that firm since he left school, and it was, in the end, the only firm he has ever worked for, in shipbuilding.
Surely that would have been a very vulnerable position in a place like Southampton.
It was. He was, at his place of work, he was an air raid shelter warden, because of course they had shelters, obviously for the men, right on the river edge. And at night time, when he came home, he was an air raid warden in the streets here. One afternoon, it was the afternoon, I've forgotten the date, when my old firm, Supermarine, was a daylight raid. The warning sounded, and I did not see it because I was here. I'm repeating my husband now. His firm was right on the river, right opposite Supermarine. I was one side of the river and he was the other when we worked. But the air raid warning sounded, and I remember him saying he went out on the slipway to look, as you did. And in the path of the sun, he said there was a cloud of German bombers coming, following the course of the river, coming out of the sun. And of course, as soon as they got, I don't know what the proximity had to be, but way down the river, they started to release their bombs, of course. And this is the afternoon when my old firm went, and one of the big shelters got a direct hit, and they were all killed. Lots of my old colleagues. See, had I still been there, I might not have been here now. My husband's firm also took a walloping the other side. By now, Southampton was in a terrible mess. A bombed streets, fire engines all over the place. I remember, no telephone connection, everything had gone. Somehow, he managed to get a message through to me. Obviously, I was worried. He was in, my mother was in Southampton as well. I was worried for her, because this was the first real heavy daylight raid, and they really made a success of it. But luckily, he came home, and he managed to get home very much late, by half walking, half cycling through the rubble. But at least he came home. And my poor mother, she was then in her 60s, I suppose. Her house had a direct hit. So that night, and my husband's house, husband's parents' house. So that night, my mother and my brother, who was living with her, came out and stayed with a friend in Totten. My husband's parents came out, and 3 sisters, and all piled in to my little house. My husband, and well, of course, in those days you didn't see your bed anyway, because when I was on duty during the daylight, I just managed to rush home about 6 o'clock in the evening to try and get something ready for a meal to prepare, and then bush back again. And by about 8 o'clock, if my husband was home, and if there was no warning on, at the time, we would just lay on the kitchen floor, siren suits, you know, then all in one suit with a zip, and with a pillow under our head, and just lay there waiting for the warning to go. and then dash out as you were, of course, straight down. And I can remember, so life was grim, really grim. But at the same time, the spirit of humour that people managed to preserve and the funny incidents that arose, that you had to see the funny side of it, will stand out forever in my mind. At the time, before we married, my husband and I were keen cyclists. We belonged to a cycling club. It's the only thing you could do in those days. Nobody had any money. But we rode tandem. And with that tandem, I think at times, we toured the whole of England and Scotland. So that when the war years came and the sirens sounded at night, if we were home, it meant we had to get on the tandem, or bikes, whichever we had, and belt straight down to headquarters. If you remember at the time, there were no street lights. Everything was blacked out. The only light you were allowed on your bicycle was a thin pencil light. You put a mask over it, just except about the size of a sixpence. One particular night, I shall always remember, because it was a good job we had a spirit of humour. The warning went. We just rose up from the kitchen floor, got on the tandem. We lived then on a house the other side of the road, which leads on to the main A36. We came out in the pitch darkness from the side road onto the main A36, took a right-hand turn to get down to Totten. But what we did not know was, on the A36, there was a massive tank convoy on its way to Southampton Docks. Excuse me. Soon as that warning sounded, they had to stop. So the tank convoy was in Salisbury Road, the main A36, but it had split at the top of our side road to allow anybody to get out. Pitch dark, sound, we didn't hear a sound, so we belted straight to find ourselves right slap bang in the middle of a tank convoy. And as soon as we got on the tandem, we heard a voice giving the order to proceed. The tanks went into action, and there was this little tandem in the middle, pedalling on it, marching up. It was an awful noise. We didn't at the time, we were pedalling like mad. And the thing is, when we got to headquarters, you couldn't signal to get off. We just threw ourselves, and hoped the tanks wouldn't take us. But it was that sort of thing afterwards. I mean, it was quite a shock. But afterwards, it caused many a laugh with the headquarters staff, you know, think we were caught up in a tank convoy. And so many silly things like that happened at the time. Reminiscing, during a long air raid, if there was no actual activity at the time, obviously at headquarters, we had gathered the ambulance drivers on duty, the first aid workers, everybody there, you know. And obviously, if you weren't actually out doing something, you were allowed to read a book, play cards, anything, you know, until you were required. At the time, we had a pile of sandbags inside as well, low, about 3 feet, to protect. This particular night, we had an ambulance driver that had been on, I think, for somewhere in the region of 30 hours, you know, constant, absolutely exhausted. He sat on the top of the sandbags, and in a very short while, he drifted off, and he laid down, you see, asleep. He was snoring peacefully, and some of the other wardens who were alert, because they were on duty, there was a very nice garden behind the headquarters, which incidentally was in a public house. And it was the licensee's garden behind, you see. One of the wardens crept out into the garden, which was a very nice garden, and picked a bunch of the landlady's flowers. He came in quietly, and the poor ambulance driver was asleep with his arms crossed on his shoulder. So he promptly put 2 or 3 flowers in his arms, and we all quietly sat and howled. Suddenly, a gas alarm sounded, and I just with my foot kicked him into action, you know. And he woke up, bleary eyes, you know, didn't know where he was or what was happening. And his mumbled mutterings, obviously, I managed to put together. He thought he'd already passed up above and I was the Archangel Gabriel. So many silly, funny things. But to retain that spirit of humour was, I think, I don't think people would have got through it without having a sense of humour.
That incident with the tank, you know, the very... Well, frightening, really, but as you say, funny as well.
Funny afterwards.
You know, it makes one wonder, When you look back at the war, do you think that there were sort of a lot of negative aspects to the blackout? Was it essential to have that blackout?
Oh, yes. Oh, yes, I think so, most decidedly. To quote a little example, I'm talking from my own experience, if you were on a bicycle, for instance, you were riding the A36, I talk about this because obviously it is the road I know and the road I was used to. From Totten up to here is a slight gradient, and as you came up, cycling up the gradient, if there was a vehicle coming the other way up, although he'd got a very masked headlight, the headlight shone upwards. Obviously, aerial activity. And I think the blackout absolutely was absolutely essential.
Did you have a job, you know, in your job as an ARP warden, with put that light out, did you find that sometimes people, you know, were annoyed?
Oh, yes, very often. And we had to reason quietly. But if we didn't, you can bet your life a neighbour would. Because everybody, obviously, for showing a light up above in this aerial activity, you're concerned for your own safety as well. Oh, yes, I mean, if we hadn't done it, there were one or two instances where I think people deliberately won't put it out. Oh, dear. It seems, looking back now, it was a long time ago, agreed, but it's the war years, I think. We're talking about the humour of the people, which I do think is the vital factor that kept people going, and their determination that they were so tired of Hitler and his rantings, their determination that they were not going to give in, and that it is amazing, really, the spirit of the people, the way they helped each other. When the siren sounded at night, you'd see women rush into perhaps a neighbour's house to help get the kiddies out, this sort of thing. They would share the food if it was necessary, and it seems to be so long ago. And when I look back in retrospect to the war years, the experience really has only reinforced an opinion I have always held. And that is that the two greatest gifts in life is not money, although it helps a lot undoubtedly, but the gifts of good health and a sense of humour. I think it can get you through almost any situation. And believe you me, it was very, very necessary in 39-45.
How important do you think Winston Churchill was when he became leader?
I think the whole spirit of the nation was transformed. Because here again, prior to the war, he was branded as a warmonger. And I can't remember now exactly when. But I do remember when it was announced that, well, he wasn't serving, Winston Churchill had taken over. To my experience, a thrill of relief went throughout the nation because his very determination, if he wanted something done, it had to be done now, no mucking about, get on with it. And throughout the grim years, his various speeches on the radio to the people were an absolute morale booster. I only wish that it had been possible to get a collection of his recorded speeches. It really put heart into you, and he didn't give you false impressions. In the beginning, I shall always remember his one speech, "It is evil things we shall be fighting." I don't remember the exact context now. "I can promise you nothing but blood, tears, toil and sweat, but in the end, certain victory." And it was the tone of his voice. Whenever he spoke, it really put heart into you. Agreed, there were people who said that blundering all, as they do, you know, but believe you me, without Winston Churchill, I honestly think it could have had a reverse effect. I shall always remember. And when the time came, when they were talking about not if invasion comes, they were talking about when invasion comes. His heartening spirits then, and his wonderful speech then, "We shall fight on the beaches, we shall fight in the streets, we shall never surrender." And I remember people going round, looking out, broomsticks and heaven only anything that could lay the hand. No, it's true, ready. And I do think they'd have had a, if they'd landed, they'd had a pretty tough tough meet greeting.
Did you really think that there would be an invasion in 1940?
Yes, I did. Probably for various reasons, of course. The odd bits you heard, you didn't know how much was true, how much was hearsay or imagination. But when we were all householders throughout the nation, were given instructions what to do or what not to do, and some of the instructions sounded, well, almost ridiculous, but there's a reason behind it. For instance, if invasion had arrived, the first thing so many people would do would be to try and get out of that particular area, civilians, to try and get out of that particular area. You were told to stay home and don't block the roads because our forces, it sounds so silly, it was the natural thing a person would go out on the road to get out of the area. But you see, there was reason, it wasn't madness, there was reason in it. But also, we were all of us issued, right throughout the nation, with a small booklet, what to do when invasion comes. And in it, you were told to start collecting now various essential items to keep you alive. If, for instance, time, food had disappeared, if you had an air raid shelter, you were told exactly what to collect, if you could, in the food line, to keep in there, bottled water, this sort of thing, and a blanket, anything to keep you alive. Because it didn't know how long, of course, it would last. And also the warning would be, if invasion occurred, the church bells of England would ring because they had been silenced, because this was the signal for invasion. And that was the thing I missed, the sound of the church bells. Here, this rather nice little area, we have a lovely old church in Totten, Ealing St. Mary's, a very old one on the hill, and had the most beautiful peal of bells. And every Sunday you could hear those bells floating across the meadows between. And which brings me to the feeling of Alamein Sunday, when the tide in North Africa turned and the church bells of England were told to ring out. I can remember standing in my bedroom window upstairs and listening to the sound of the bells and thinking, how lovely, you know, how you'd miss them. And that, of course, really, I think, was the beginning of the real turn of the tide. And Dunkirk evacuation, again, in this particular area, it was a terrible, worrying time, of course, for everybody, wondering what was going to be the outcome of it. My brother-in-law came through the Dunkirk evacuation. He was in the medical services. And he managed to send a telegram home to my sister, his wife, of course. And she came down to me to show me the telegram. Obviously, she had been worried like everybody. And in it, somewhere along the line, the transcription had been slightly altered. Jack, her husband, had put just a few brief words. They were allowed, the forces men, just a few brief words in a telegram. He'd put in it, just merely, landed England, Jack. That's all, my sister. Somewhere in the transcription, it had gone wrong, and he got, long live England. But I thought, well, how, you know, from a serving man, how, I thought that was rather lovely, you know. But when that happened, the Dunkirk veterans, in this area anyway, I imagine they landed at Southampton. And they were transshipped out to one of the local schools here, Totten School. Tired, exhausted, dirty, dishevelled. But I remember the women of Ealing, it's the area over there. The handwritten notices that appeared outside on their gates. Free baths for troops. And you could only have 5 inches of water for a bath. But all over, those little houses put out notices. In the tin bath, perhaps, in front of the fire. But they took the fellows in, and they didn't care. It didn't matter in those days. Stripped them of their clothing, wrapped them in a blanket, put them to bed to get to sleep anyway. And while they were sleeping, then they'd come down and have a bath and their clothes would have been washed, ready to go. It's that sort of spirit that held the nation together.
Did you feel very alone at that time? you know, with the Blitzkrieg through the Low Countries and the fall of France.
The uncertainty, really, in your heart. This old country of ours has stood for so long that I couldn't imagine it going under. But at the same time, there was that awful apprehensive feeling, the way Hitler had swept through the Low Countries. And after all, we were only a small nation compared to what he had... But no, as it happened, I think the hand of Providence was over this nation. And I will say, wonderful leadership of Winston Churchill. I won't hear anybody run Winston Churchill down. Because a thing that makes me cross, even now, in these days, is when you get a young person, either on television, radio, or even writing about it, about the war, and being critical, when they weren't even born. I don't think they're entitled to criticise or even pass an opinion. You had to live through it to know.